All right, so in continuing with the C9 conversations, you've seen a few already on Channel 9. Today we're very lucky to have Yuri Gurevich, who is a logician and researcher in MSR, creator of Abstract State Machine, which you'll learn about, and a number of other interesting things in sort of the logic of computation. Thanks for coming on Channel 9.
I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. So, what's your story? Tell us a little bit about how you got into where you are today.
I grew up in Soviet Union.
Okay.
Was trained as a mathematician. And when I got my bachelor's degree, a friend of mine gave me a freshly translated American textbook in logic. And logic was sort of forbidden in Soviet Union.
Interesting.
It is the logic of authoritarian state is different from logic of free state.
Interesting. So there is no sort of independent logic, huh?
Right. So let me explain. In a free state, anything which is not forbidden is allowed. In the totalitarian state, everything which is not allowed is forbidden.
Certainly.
Okay, it's a bit of exaggeration, but you feel where we go. And the logic was associated with the positivist philosophy because of Vienna Circle, where Gödel and others participated. And there is nothing particularly wrong with positivism philosophy, except that it was different from dialectical materialism practiced in Soviet Union, and therefore wrong. And but when I finished college, it was sort of allowed. Books were translated. There was no professors, at least in my place, to teach logic. But I had a book, and I studied from that book.
And taught yourself?
Taught myself. I should admit that I haven't watched Channel 9 until this morning.
Wow.
When I looked up various materials on your website.
Excellent.
And I noticed a very passionate and enthusiastic defense of functional programming. May I say propaganda?
Interesting. Yes, you may.
Programming. And I think functional programming is wonderful, but I'm a little bit on a skeptical side.
Interesting.
So let me make a couple of points, if
please
I may.
Please do, of course.
So one point is that functional programming is not very new. So in fact, the first language designed to be a language of functional programming, namely Lisp, was designed by John McCarthy in 1950s. So before the C programming language. And I guess there is only one language in wide use today which is older than Lisp, and this is Fortran. Another point is that functional programming is a special case of declarative programming, which includes also other declarative kinds of programming, for example, logic programming. But imperative programming is out there. It is not displaced throughout all these years.
Sure.
In fact, the computer revolution that we all watch or participate in made largely by, with all respect to functional languages, which made wonderful contributions. The computer revolution is driven largely by imperative programming. And this is for a reason, I think.
Okay, and what is that reason?
Let's see, before I go into this, let me mention that I don't know anybody who makes this case.
So we have not had this case made on Channel 9 until just right now. But this is great. So
So I looked up this morning. I tried to Bing and Google wipe functional programming, and a lot of articles came up, in particular a famous article by John Hughes, Why Functional Programming
Matters. Yes,
exactly, with a passionate push for functional programming. And then I wrote Why Imperative Programming, and there were no hits of relevance.
Interesting.
I don't know how to explain why it was not defended, but so let me see. In fact, I'm not such an expert on programming. I'm more on specifications.
Absolutely.
So I worked on specifications for a long time. So maybe I can make this point on the specifications.
Sure.
So in specifications, the declarative approaches dominated the field for a long time. The whole field seems to be tailor-made for specifications, for declarative specifications. And declarative was, for most people, sort of good by definition. Some people bother to argue that declarative approach is the one to go. But I think for others it was sort of obvious. Mm. Not unsimilar the way the word socialist was understood in Soviet Union. Sort of good by definition.
Okay.
Now, as a mathematician, at least in my past, I certainly like declarative, but I find it somewhat limited and maybe impractical. Mm. Now, my critique will be a bit unfair to declarative programming because it's not so pure as declarative specification tends to be.
I see. So
in declarative programming, they often design language as purely declarative. So the program is just an expression with no side effects, evaluate it, and that's it. But then they quickly discover that it doesn't take them too far, and so the language either dies or acquires ways to deal with a state in typically indirect, limited, and often hard to understand way. So my critique will be more of the purely declarative approaches. So certain things just hard to specify declaratively. Think, for example, sorting.
Okay.
If you just want to say, I want to sort this array, then you can say declaratively, because you start from your items in an arbitrary order, and you finish them in a perfect order.
Sure.
But if you want to say that you want them to be sorted in a particular way, so for example, you want to say, I want sorting to be done in place. So none of the items ever leaves the array. It just stays there.
Okay.
It may be important for efficiency, for security reasons. And typically my declarative friend would insist that sorting in place is a kind of implementational issue. But for my coworkers in Microsoft, they wouldn't buy them. They need sorting in place, and that's important. Specification should should be like that. And operationally, or imperatively, or procedurally, it is very easy to define such a in-place programming. So you say, pick any two items which are in wrong order, and switch them. sort of non-deterministically.
I see.
Pick another pair of items which are in the wrong order, mm-hmm. and switch them. Keep going. This is not the most efficient way, but non-determinism doesn't have to be resolved that way. So if you think about very clever sorting, say, Tony Hoare's, what's it called? Quicksort.
Quicksort, of course.
Right, quicksort. Yeah. It's just clever way to choose a pair to switch.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that description is quite generic and can be easily implemented, which works in small examples. Mm-hmm. So you can build a prototype and try this. And here is one little example where you see that this imperative nature or operational nature is quite important.
Absolutely.
Another reason is that suppose you have a declarative specification of certain to say protocol or algorithm. Mm-hmm. How do you know that the specification and the implementation fit each other? Since it's declarative, you cannot play with it.
Okay. Interesting.
You can play it in your mind, but you cannot really test. Mm-hmm. So if it is operational, or as they say, executable, then you can actually play with it. And that can take you far.
Absolutely. Now, speaking about that, I mean, when mm-hmm. you think about, you know, you created essentially a methodology for understanding the fundamental behavior of, or we can call it, the most abstract nature of an algorithm using an abstract state machine. Mm-hmm. Can we kind of talk about that for a little while? What is an abstract state machine?
Okay. There is a Hebrew saying that sometimes a cow wants to be milked more than the young want the milk. So it's quite a dangerous topic,
sure,
for me to start talking upon. So in 1980s, I moved from mathematics to computer science. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to understand, what do they do there?
Sure.
What it's really about. And I was fortunate to get a tenured position right away, so I didn't have to immediately prove myself to anybody. So one example that tenure worked as intended.
Uh-huh.
So I took my time to understand what actually goes on, not only read papers, theoretical papers, but to go and to speak to people in the trenches, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I asked my chairman that I would like to teach programming. And he said, no. We hired you to teach theory. We have enough people to teach programming.
Hmm.
I said, but how will I become real computer scientist if I teach theory? Yeah. I will always stay in theory.
Hmm.
He said, okay, you teach programming once. So I taught programming. There was like 200 or 300 people in the class, and I was a little bit ahead of them in my textbooks.
Okay.
And I was teaching programming on example of Pascal.
Uh-huh.
And then I discovered that two implementations of Pascal that were available to me, one on a little Macintosh and another on the big mainframe at the University of Michigan, disagreed.
Interesting.
And now, what I'm to do? I'm going to teach, but I'm not sure what Pascal is. You know, as a mathematician, you know things that you teach from first principles.
Mm.
And now I need to teach Pascal, I'm not sure what it is. So I went to the library and got, you know, 2 dozen books, and none of them addressed the questions whether the two implementations disagreed. Mm. So that's how I got into thinking about semantics of programming. Mm-hmm. And possibly because of coming from mathematics, this declarative theoretical papers on declarative specification or semantics didn't quite convince me. Mm. Because they wouldn't address the difficult questions in programming languages, like how do you deal with interrupts? And the theoretical friends of mine didn't want to deal with that. And so eventually I came to the idea that semantics should be operational. And I think one reason that declarative approaches are so dominating in specification is some kind of really misunderstanding. Mm. I think people confuse between declarative and abstract.
Ah.
So declarative specifications tend to be abstract. And there is a tendency to think that operational specifications will be low-level implementations. And I was convinced that you can be operational or imperative or procedural and abstract, that in fact the two aspects are orthogonal.
Interesting.
And so that's how I came to idea of having some kind of very abstract machines, because in the heart of computer theory there are Turing machines.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very abstract, but very low level. Mm. You really program on the level of single bits. So the question was, can you program on a high level, on as high level as necessary? Certainly Turing machines cannot do it. Mm-hmm. So the question was, can you elevate sort of Turing's thesis and capture algorithms not on the level of single bits, but on high level? And
with high level, like types and classes and
right,
I mean stuff that we take for granted as developers.
Right. So you want to speak at the time was procedure calls.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And interrupts, without going into details, dirty details, but the fact that you are interrupted by itself is quite an abstract issue.
Sure.
What happens when an interrupt comes? Mm-hmm. And so
let me just real quickly, I mean, because this is fun, because this is a C9 conversation, so we can go off into a little jaunt into, Alice's Wonderland. And, you know, in some sense, abstract, the terminology abstract, in and of itself is kind of abstract, depending upon how you define it. So abstract meaning hard to really understand in the context of what you're used to experiencing, or abstract in the sense that it's the purest form of some sort of simplified expression of what something is, or in terms of a specification like we have with an abstract class in object-oriented programming, where it's like partially defined or partially implemented but fully specified and required by consumers to do things a certain way. So define abstract in your world.
Okay, good question. Let me give by an example.
Sure.
So when I started to program, for a year I programmed for life, for living, and Soviet Union was behind, at least in academia.
Sure.
So I programmed on a naked machine, 001 for addition, 002 for subtraction.
Wow.
Yes. Then assembly programming came.
Okay.
And it was more abstract, because you don't have to actually specify where exactly you are in the memory. You have symbolic names.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's a higher level of abstraction.
Understood.
Then languages came, or at least I learned languages like C, mm-hmm. which were higher yet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then if you consider C-sharp or Java, their abstraction level higher yet. Mm-hmm. So what happens, there are various levels of abstraction. And you may describe computation on the chosen level. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you want to describe the semantics of the C programming language, you don't want to deal with electrical circuits or with locations in the memory. You have some kind of abstract C machine, which really deals usually with bytes, but rarely with bits. And that's the level where you live. Not below, not above. That's the level on which you want to describe the meaning.
I see.
So in fact, a student of mine, Jim Huggins and myself, gave first semantics of the full C language with all the details. Mm-hmm.
So essentially, it's an abstraction layer.
Yes.
So in Windows, you have, or many operating systems, the operating system by definition abstracts the hardware, and you have a hardware abstraction layer. The software operating system never goes anywhere below that.
You got it.
Okay. So it's abstraction in that sense.
Right. There's a whole hierarchy of level.
Understood.
And this, the same sort of the same algorithm can be thought of on different levels. Mm. You can think about what happens from the point of view of physics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or you can think about bits.
Interesting.
Yes. Now, on certain high level, you don't see any bits. You may speak about procedure calls. Mm. Okay. Or classes, mm-hmm. and the methods. Mm. And so the question is, can you have a machine model which is able to describe algorithm on any level of abstraction of interest to you? Mm-hmm. And that would be much more universal machine model than Turing machines.
Interesting.
Because Turing machines are universal from the point of view that take whatever functions from natural numbers to natural numbers, then there is a Turing machine that computes the same function. But of course, Turing machine may compute it in a very, very baroque way, where, say, in PL1, you multiply arbitrary matrices at once.
Interesting.
A poor Turing machine will walk back and forth for a long time to multiply two matrices painfully on this long tape. And so a priori it seems that the task is impossible. But then you may think, okay. Suppose there are such machines. Mm-hmm. How they would look like? And you try to analyze, mm-hmm. and that's how I came to abstract state machines.
Interesting.
One thing was to understand what's a state.
Yes. What do you mean by that?
Right. So often people say, and write in textbooks, that a state is given by the variables. Mm. And this is, in fact, not correct. Mm. So imagine you have a C program, say, with three variables, X, Y, Z. And you know the values of X and Y and Z, current values. Do you know the state? In fact, not necessarily, because you have to know where you are in the program.
Yeah.
And program may have procedures or functions, as we say in C. Mm-hmm. And so in your stack, you may have a whole bunch of frames which are unfinished computations. And that's all really part of the state. So the cleverness in designing programming languages is to create a simpler picture. So often you can think of a state as if given just by the values of the variables. But it's an illusion. And that's why the semantics, say, of C is hard, because a lot of things are swept under the rug. So my definition of state was, state is, let me say it in the deterministic case, the simplest case. State is information which, together with a program, completely determines the rest of the computation. So in the non-deterministic case, it determines the set of possible computations.
Interesting.
And it generalizes to interactive computations and so on. So a state is information which, together with a program, defines the future of the computation.
Very interesting. And so that's sort of fundamental to an algorithm that, that does it's, something.
Right. And when you want to formalize what the state is, there's a huge step to determining the level of abstraction on which you find yourself.
So let's talk a little bit about one of the papers you've written is an investigation in some sense the impossibility of using an abstract state machine to determine whether or not two algorithms are the same. Let's talk about algorithm equivalence. Why is it, you know, why are you writing papers about this and talking about how it's impossible? What's going on here?
So it came up because of the following issue. The question is, how do you think about an algorithm?
Yes.
And there are two popular ways to think about it. One way, an algorithm is just a program. Maybe very abstract. Maybe on a very high level abstraction. But it's just a program.
Okay.
And implementation is another algorithm which implements that program. There is a relation between two algorithms that refines and that the lower one refines the upper one and the upper one coarsens the lower one.
I see.
Another point of view is that an algorithm is a kind of pie in the sky. It's a kind of idea. And any program of it is just an implementation. And intuitively, it seems very appealing because you have two different programs and you say, well, but it's the same algorithm. Yes. And it seems to make good sense. And in the beginning of this abstract state machine project, I had to make a decision. So which way to go? And I went the way that algorithms are programs.
Okay.
And in among logicians, the other point of view is very popular.
Sure.
And so eventually time came when there were three of us working in abstract state machines and we wanted to reply to those people and also to investigate to ourselves.
Sure.
So whether the other point of view sort of has legs. And we thought, the answer is no. Now, you cannot prove a theorem because this is a point of view rather than a mathematical statement.
Okay.
So this paper, why about when two algorithms are equivalent, is kind of semi-philosophical. So we argue against the point of view as algorithm as a pie in the sky.
Okay.
So let me give a couple of arguments.
Sure.
So imagine you invent and publish a beautiful algorithm. Okay. Then I come and publish another algorithm, and I'm very proud. Mm-hmm. You look and you say, gosh, but it's essentially my algorithm. We may argue forever. Mm-hmm. In my eyes, they will be definitely different. In your eyes, they will be definitely the same.
Interesting.
In fact, I remember when I went to my very first conference in Russia, in algebra, conference on algebra. There was a lot of people, and a famous professor, a big guy, mm-hmm. was giving a talk. Suddenly, another famous professor sitting far away shouted, your theorem follows from my theorem. Then the speaker says, well, it is a theorem. It follows from anywhere because it's a theorem.
Interesting.
It's just true.
Sure.
The other guy says, you know what I mean. This guy says, no, I don't. And so it went on. So essentially the question was whether the two theorems are the same or not.
Yes.
So similarly with algorithms. But even if you remove that immediate involvement, mm-hmm. So we have other arguments. Mm-hmm. So we take two different kinds of sorting. And people in sorting would definitely agree that it's two different algorithms. And now you start to massage. You take this algorithm, slightly change it. And each change is very slight, so definitely it should be equivalent. Mm-hmm. But eventually we arrive to another algorithm, which is different kind of sorting.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And so on. It is.
That's the story.
I hope you write a well-argued paper.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, because in some sense, I mean, what if you have two algorithms that have the same state? In other words, at some instance, say the end, mm-hmm. or towards the end, or whatever, towards the, you know, before the thing is done computing, where the state is almost identical. And so at the end of the day, you're going to get a green turtle that comes out of both ones. So mm-hmm. can you use your abstraction concept to pull far enough back from an abstraction standpoint and go, yeah, those two things are the same? Because far enough out, they do exactly the same thing.
So if you think about input-output relation, mm-hmm. then this is very clear.
Sure.
When two algorithms are the same. But there is much more to an algorithm that the function computes.
Okay.
For example, one algorithm may be very quick, whereas another may be slow.
Sure.
One may be very, very abstract, and another do a lot of go into very detailed computation. They may definitely sort of do different things.
Sure.
So what happens is that there are many meaningful notions of equivalence. So having the same input-output relation is, or function, mm-hmm. is one such meaningful notion of equivalence, but there is no one overarching notion of equivalence of algorithm good for all purposes.
Okay, excellent. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what you work on these days. So you've been thinking a lot about security.
Yes.
And, of course, algorithms play a very big role in securing systems. Yeah, you've written programming language, KCAL, I believe?
Decal,
sorry. And let's talk a little bit about the work and the thinking that's going on with you in terms of security and security computing.
So that's actually did not come as natural continuation of my previous work. I met on some Microsoft function. Uh-huh. I met one of architects that at the time just came to Microsoft.
Okay.
His name is Slava Kavsan. He is now the head of Windows security team.
Excellent.
And he tells me, he approaches me and says, somebody told me you're from Russia. I'm from Russia too. So we started to discuss things.
Okay.
And he was interested in, at least at the time, in policy languages. Mm. And me being a logician, sort of naturally very interesting to me because kind of policy written as kind of logic programming. And so we started to discuss. I was learning things from him. Hopefully he learned something from me, consulted me on the logic part of things. Mm-hmm. And somehow eventually I got into this field. And one scenario that was interested to him was user-centric scenario. So imagine you sit somewhere in a hotel, say in Italy, mm-hmm. and you want to do various operations, you know, maybe with Microsoft, with HP, maybe you can buy something, or maybe with Dell, Credentica. So you have to approach different authorities. And there are various policies that you have to obey. Mm-hmm. So I suppose you're Microsoft, as a Microsoft employee, you have to obey Microsoft policies or respect mm-hmm. policies some other players.
Sure.
And desirably to do it in a kind of automatic way. And the languages that I saw in the literature were not decentralized. So often the principles were spread all over the world, but there was always a central engine which did all the computation. But if you sit in your Italian hotel room, mm-hmm. where is the central engine? Which computes what you need to do, what Microsoft needs to do, what you know, Amazon needs to do. Or
sure.
If you want to buy something from Amazon and, mm-hmm. and get some various permissions from Microsoft. So, and another logician was visiting me. Mm-hmm. His name is Itai Neeman. He's a star in set theory. And he was interested.
Set theory.
Far away. But he was interested, what do they do in computer science?
Sure.
So between the two of us, I was sort of an engineer, and so he wanted to learn things.
Cool.
And he came to visit me, and I was thinking about this policy languages, and so we formed a team, and we designed a very expressive language, which is definitely decentralized. Mm. So. It's called Distributed Knowledge Authorization Language.
DECAL.
DECAL. Mm-hmm. So there are principles spread, and each one of them computes his, her, their mm-hmm. Own knowledge in their own place. And there was a lot of there was need in such languages because there are many in many cases a number of policies are involved. So, for example, in health, you need to respect FDA's policies, but then there's HIPAA. Now the question is. Do the policy of FDA and the policy of HIPAA contradict each other? Or maybe a better question, where exactly they contradict each other? Mm-hmm. Another question is our, say, Microsoft policy in compliance, say, with FDA policy? So in such cases, you compare different policies.
Interesting.
And that's what such a language is for.
All right, so, you know, just one question that I want to ask you is, you know, in your mind, what's the hardest problem in your field, in your area of knowledge, of interest, that's left unsolved. What's one of the biggest problems in logic as it relates to computation?
It's like asking you to choose among your children. Which is the favorite.
Fair enough. Yes. Let me pause it a little differently. You know, if you had to choose one area to really dive down and focus on, where you see there's a lot of room for, where there's a lot of lack of knowledge at this point, what would that be?
So one tends to be enthusiastic about what you do now.
Sure.
So now I'm working on these policy languages, and that seems to me extremely exciting.
Sure.
So in fact, what we discovered that originally this decal was intended for authorization, but as professional logicians, we looked for good foundation for it, and I think we did find an interesting foundation, which is well known in logic, so-called constructive logic, or also known as intuitionistic logic. So it became our foundation, and when we understood that, we succeeded to define special authorization constructs in purely logical means. So now we think needs some work to understand this better, but we think that our language is able to deal with policies, with security policies that are not necessarily authorization, or with policies which are not necessarily security policies. So an example of security policy which is not necessarily an authorization could be that every 6 weeks you have to change your password. An example of policy that not necessarily security, though security is such a wide concept, is, let's see, suppose you come to a doctor and they tell you, before you fill this questionnaire, doctor cannot see you. So now we are thinking to reinterpret this A in decal. Maybe it is distributed knowledge and action language or something.
Interesting. I mean, that's sort of a challenge, though, right? To
it
write
is
this
a challenge.
One language to encompass, to essentially abstract.
Right.
It is a really hard problem.
It is a hard problem, and there are various ways to approach it. One way is to look what people use right now, and to cater to the needs, which seems very reasonable.
Excellent.
And one definitely should do that. But we chose to go from first principles so that the language is clean and have a foundation which allows us to scale it and keep complexity down, all the time making sure that we cover the scenarios needed to our customers.
Very interesting. Now, of course, one of the things I remember, now the Niners should recognize Yuri because he was on Channel 9 before as a participant in an Expert to Expert with Eric Meyer and Bertrand Meyer.
Right. For about 1 minute. Right?
Yes, I mean, you had to leave, right? Because I guess you had to go to a meeting.
Right.
And as usual, you know, we invited you in randomly. Eric was like, Yuri, come here. So, which I love. I mean, that's a great thing. But one of the things you said that's really stuck with me, and I've actually argued with people trying to, because I think it's a very interesting talking, you know, an argument point or a thing to debate, is in trying to solve this concurrency problem, right, the problem of all this power afforded to us, but we're sequential imperative programmers trying to understand how to rationalize programming a complicated, concurrent system with I don't know, 1,000 CPUs? Who knows what it's going to be in the near future? And one of the things you said that stuck with me was that we are sequential. Mm-hmm. The way that we, like we're talking right now, you're not thinking about 40 other things at the same time, even though you have a pretty concurrent capability, one would assume, in our brains. Can we just kind of just touch on that real briefly?
Sure. Actually, first time I thought about it when I was reading Freud.
Interesting.
Which was also not allowed in Soviet Union. Hmm. So I read it in the copies, so-called samizdat. Somebody took time to actually type it.
Wow.
It was a terrible copy, hard to read.
I see.
But Freud was explaining how people make errors when they speak. Mm. You know, somebody speaks to his wife, who is, say, Sarah, and suddenly he says, Natasha.
Uh-huh.
And wife becomes suspicious.
Exactly.
And in fact, he says, for a good reason. Mm. Often for a good reason. Of course, it could be completely innocent.
Sure.
So what happens that at each moment, the thought can branch in various direction. Mm. But our brains cannot follow several or even two directions.
I see.
Eventually, there is a stem, and you cut those branches and keep going. And so when suddenly you say something, the chances are it appeared in another branch. It came to your mind. Yeah. You could go there.
Sure.
Okay. And this picture of a stem where you chop away the branches kind of stuck with me. And I think it's really true. Mm. And when we try to, in our head, to understand a parallel program and imagine how it happens, we just physically, you know, physiologically, it is nearly impossible to run in your mind in concurrently different computations and see how they interact.
Absolutely.
So there is a psychological barrier there. And I think history confirms that. For example, there is this famous, what is it called? Bakery algorithm. Mm-hmm. You know, people come to the bakery and somehow we have to decide who will go first. And so somebody wrote this algorithm, published, and it looked convincing. Mm-hmm. Then another guy found an error, corrected. So eventually, until Leslie Lamport came and gave sort of a definitive proof.
Sure.
So there were just good people made a mistake again and again. Mm. Because it just in your mind, it's difficult to replay those scenarios.
Very interesting. Well, I mean, there's typical Microsoft. People are waiting for this conference room. It's been great talking to you, Yuri. You've done a lot of great work. Yeah. Very interesting life.
I enjoyed it very much.
Cool.
Yeah, thank you.
So maybe we'll see you in C9 lectures sometime.
Okay.
Give a lecture on some very interesting algorithm. Thank you.
Thank you.